programme portrait of an actress, Marie Mullen returns to her student ground in Galway. Hello and welcome to the Bank of Ireland Theatre here at NUI Galway. Our guest is one of Ireland's great actors, someone who illuminates the stage and brings enormous depth, courage and strength to all the work she does. Marie Mullen began her acting career here in what was then UCG, where the foundations for Druid Theatre Company were laid down. Over several decades, she has brought to vivid life many of the great characters of theatre in plays by Singh, Tom Murphy, Tennessee Williams, Martin McDonagh, Brian Friel, and many, many others. Her power and presence on stage have been recognised with the Tony Award on Broadway, the high praise of critics and public at home in Britain and in the US, and most recently, a special tribute award at this year's Irish Times Theatre Awards. Thinking of Marie Mullen's work, I'm reminded of the words of the playwright Michael Frayn in his book Stage Directions, where he says, "Actors, like writers, must bring their own living selves to the enterprise of theatre. In my experience, most actors are more mutually supportive than the people I know in other professions. The risks they take through their exposure on stage are so frightening that on the whole they tend to make common cause and help each other out, like soldiers in battle. The more I think about the courage an actor needs to go out on stage, especially on opening night, the more I admire it." Please welcome Marie Mullen.
Thank you, Vincent, for that wonderful introduction. I'm not sure it's deserved, but I thank you from the bottom of my heart.
A soldier on stage at times. Sometimes does it feel like that?
Oh, it does. I mean, the older I get, the more nervous I get for every opening night, because it's like the more you know you don't know. And it just gets worse. But once you go on stage, once you actually get the first line out, you begin to relax and sort of take on your job for the night, whatever it might be.
Galway, of course, a home from home for you. Take us back to the days when you first came to Galway. I mean, it was a very different city. I remember the first time I came here was the early 1980s, and it was entirely different to anywhere else I knew. And it has changed so much since.
It really has. And but still, I have to say about Galway, it's still very beautiful. And there's still places that you can find where you can find the old Galway, or the Galway that meant something to me in the 70s, we'll say, and the 80s and 90s, of course. But when I came here to college first, it was a very small college, but I have very fond memories of my time here. It was, if you can imagine, I was surrounded by mostly students from the west of Ireland, you know, Sligo, Mayo, Leitrim, Galway, a few from Limerick, and that sort of, mostly that kind of west of Ireland accents and that around us. And in those days, we were trying to express ourselves, and the kind of upbringing we had, like, you know, I mean, I lived in a small village in Ireland in County Sligo, and I was the eldest of, I am the eldest of nine children. And my father worked in the P&T of the time, and we also had a small farm. So there was that, I came from that kind of background. I did go to boarding school in Mayo, and went home for holidays. So that was kind of the basis of my life. And when I came here, there was a lot of other students who had the same kind of upbringing as I had. And when we sort of explored the arts and that sort of thing, that's the kind of background we were bringing to whatever interested us at the time.
I want to talk to you in a while about the foundations of Druid and meeting Gary Hines here and all of that. But going back again, you know, to childhood, when do you feel you knew you wanted to be an actor, or when did that spark light for you? Did you see a play early on? Was there something that set it off?
I did actually see a play that compounded it all for me. When I was in boarding school, my second year, we were all taking on a bus from Tourmaquidy to Claremorris, and Micheál MacLiomhar was performing in Claremorris with the importance of being Oscar, which was a whole kind of series of characters that he performed on his own, of all the characters from Oscar Wilde. And I was just completely and utterly enthralled. I had never seen anything like it in my whole life. And I think at that stage, I wanted to see if I could be a performer. But before that, I used to go to the local, in Riverstown, there was a local group who performed every year, and we always went to the play. And everybody laughed because you recognised the butcher or the shopkeeper up there, or wearing the lady from the post office wearing a different dress and a different hairstyle. And it was funny. And, you know, there was a huge tradition of going to plays in Ireland even before any of this started, really.
Of amateur drama, essentially.
Absolutely, yeah.
Was there any acting at all that you knew of in the family? I mean, was there anyone else who liked to do a turn or tell a story or do anything?
I'm afraid not, but and there are some. I have a sister who's everybody thinks in her homeland that she's much better than me and doesn't know why, in the name of God, she's not professional and I'm. And she's a very good actress, I have to say. No, my family, my parents loved films. They met in the 50s, and they went to see everything. And my father had a Honda 50 in those days, and they travelled to Boyle and Ballymote and Sligo just to see all the movies. And there was always talk of the film stars in our house. And my father always enjoyed the performances and talked about them, and my mother the same. And they'd laugh, and I suppose it was that in the house. But other than that, not really anything in particular.
But something stuff.
Something. It's just stories and things. I mean, I suppose it's to do with stories. I never thought I'd be a performer, but that seemed to be where the best way of getting it out of myself in one sense. But I loved to listen to stories. There was always loads of stories going around and people coming in to tell stories and that sort of thing, as there is now in Ireland.
Here, when you came to university, to UCG then, you were studying arts, thinking you might be a teacher, and you studied archaeology. And I'm kind of interested in that because it sometimes strikes me that there are certain parallels between the work of an actor, the work of an archaeologist. You know, you're digging,
excavating,
trying to pull things out and put something together and make a hole again.
Yeah. Well, when I came to the university, I was going to do a science degree. Thank God I didn't. I'd never have had time to do my exams if I was doing science.
The new Pope studied chemistry.
Did he? So, you know, goodness me.
Might have set you on the right path.
There you go. But there was somebody, in an advisory capacity, told me that maybe I should think about doing arts instead of science. So, and then archaeology, I was always interested in geography, and I knew I thought it might complement, but actually it turned out that the archaeology was my favourite subject in the whole degree course. You know, I did Irish and geography and archaeology for degree. Yeah.
I suppose a lot has been said and written about the foundation of Druid and you meeting Gary Hines, Dramsock, that first production of The Loves of Cass McGuire. But just remind us of that. What were you all like?
What were you all like? We were, I was a really quiet, nice country person, trying to find my way. But Gary Hines was obnoxious from the very start. No, she had a youthful arrogance, but also she had a sense of her own self that maybe a lot of us in those days didn't really get at that time, and we needed to be led in some way. I mean, she was very enthusiastic about everything she did in her life. And there was another guy, Patsy McGarry, who's now writes for the Irish Times. He was one of our friends as well, of those, Mairead Noon, who works in RTE. There was a whole group of people who were thinkers and doers in the university at that time. And I think that was why we were all interested in drama. And we all supported each other in each one. The Litton Deb was going out, Patsy and Mairead Noon. But Gary was interested in drama. And I think we just wanted to put on a play. And Gary, we went to auditions. Everybody went to auditions. And Gary wanted to do The Loves of Cass McGuire, so she held open auditions. And I remember it was down to myself and another red-haired girl who I've forgotten. We were 17 at the time. She had a better American accent than me. So Gary got the two of us to read a section from the play. And then she just stood there looking at both of us like this, you know. And we were just wondering what would happen, and thankfully she picked me for some reason. I don't know why. But I was so glad. So that was the start, really. She was in my archaeology class, so I used to see her 4 times a week, and we'd talk about rehearsals and things. I mean, she was also very innocent and by the way, you know. But she proved to be an extraordinarily visionary woman at the time, and we all learned a lot of her in those early days.
She clearly had that instinct from the start. I mean, spotting you making that choice. There's a great line as well about a coat?
Yes, the Tumikidi coat. Yes, it was tweed with a fur or a velvet collar. And it was the only coat I had. I mean, I had it for 5 years in secondary school, and it was a lovely, big, warm coat. So, you know, I just looked like somebody who wasn't wearing her secondary school uniform here in college. But she always says that I stood out in my coat. Yeah.
Cass Maguire, of course, again, you know, you were playing this, what, 80-year-old
woman? 80-year-old woman at 17. And we were invited to go to festivals, and everybody thought it was a great effort by young people. But, I mean, if you can imagine, we thought we were all great. But, I mean, it must have been terrible with a young 17-year-old playing a drunken 80-year-old with two bags and accents and everything. I mean, it must have been horrendous. But we got a lot of praise going around the circuit, and people were very positive to us, you know. And but the following year and the following two years, we were beginning to develop our talents a bit, and we did better at the festivals in the years that followed.
You won, I think, was it the most promising actress?
Young actress in Tubbercurry, yes. Most promising young actress for Cass, yes.
I don't remember much of it. You were back there recently.
Well, they asked us to go back because Gary and I, they asked us to go back because we were there. The lady who ran it passed away, and she was, we knew her all through our Druid lives. We knew this lady. She did so much work for the amateur scene. She asked us last year to come back, and unfortunately she died before we could go back, but we had a wonderful time. And Gary said that night that all of our drama came... Druid came from the amateur movement, and we must always remember that. It's so strong, and it's so much to do with us as a culture. And we love drama, we love stories, we love, exploring plays and all that. And only for the amateur movement, we would not be here, I believe.
Later then, you know, Druid did emerge, and we'll talk in a while about McNally and his presence and his role in it all. But those days with people like Ray McBride, Sean McGinley, Melissa Stafford, they must have been really, really exciting.
They were, but I mean, you have to remember, Vincent, that I'm only saying we all went to work and we're getting this play on in 3 weeks' time. We didn't think, oh, aren't we doing great things? And it's all only with hindsight that we can see it survived this long. And I still don't understand how. But in those days when... Druid started off, and Sean McGinley and Melissa Stafford to Ray McBride, they came in 77. Mick and I and Gary were more or less there in 75, 76 with some help from Raid Noon and in the first season. And then we were there on our own for about a year, as far as I remember. And then Sean and Melissa and Ray came. And oh, Paul O'Neill was with us from the start, who was very influential as well. But it was that small. And we were looking for two-handers, three-handers to put on because we had no money. And then it began to develop a style. Gary was at the helm, and then we were developing our skills as actors. We were beginning to see on what worked with an audience, what didn't, how they rejected us in some things, they didn't like us, or we didn't communicate with them. And it was all about communication and Gary saying, well, you see, this is when you did that happened. And not talking over laughs, just ordinary things we learned how to do on the hoof. And then we began to get very talented people to come and help us, like Gabby Dowling and Monica Frawley came very early on. There was two young girls came from Limerick. They were teachers that gave up their teaching jobs and asked for jobs. They came and they expanded the acting corps, and we began to influence each other. But it was a handful of people in those days.
And you really started on a shoestring.
We did. The first season in 75, we did it here, and we'll talk about Mick joining us. We were all going to go and work after that first season. £350 we got from Borth Fáilte in 75, summer of 75. And then I think a year or two later, the Arscal came in with 1,000. And so that was, and then there was, I think there was 300 in the early days from the Galway Arts, the Galway Town Council or something. There was, but a gesture like that. So it started with very, very little money, and everybody did everything. Sean and Melissa did the electrics and the set. I did all the costumes until Monica came. And, you know, it was just a mix of people from the start.
Mick Lally then as well. Mick coming in, yes. Obviously essential to everything.
So essential. Off. Wednesday we went to the cellar bar where he drank and said, please will you do the Playboy for the summer season, Gary and myself. And he was already teaching in Tuam at the time. He says, no, I'm going to London on Saturday to work on the building sites. And he says, but check in on Friday in case I change my mind. So we checked into the cellar on Friday and he was there. And he says, okay, I'll do it. And really, I mean, that was it, because we were going to go, Gary was going to go to America, I was going to go to England that summer if he didn't. I know Dave McGrath and a couple of people were saying, well, will we or won't we? So once Mick said yes, we all fell into place, and we did that summer season with three plays, The Loves of Cass Maguire, The Playboy, and it's a 2 foot 6 inches above the ground world. I don't know why we did that. Just that was to bring the audience in, that one. And Playboy was a potboiler. We thought, you know, the Irish Camalia, they'll all come in for that. We didn't realise at that time that it was such an amazing, wonderful play, and that Singh was so extraordinary, because we didn't know. And so that was the first season, and it did quite well in the jazz. And then afterwards, Mick and myself and Gary decided to stay on and try and do another play in the autumn with whatever money we had left.
Singh and that first production of Playboy, you know, obviously almost rediscovering the power, the glory of Singh's work through that. You know, a few years ago then, of course, you were essential to that extraordinary production, that Singh cycle that drew it.
Yeah.
And an amazing feat of endurance as an actor for you in doing that. I mean, it was amazing to see, to witness. And again, that reminder of the glory of Singh's language. I mean, nobody like him.
And I mean, we Mick was fantastic Playboy that year. I was Peggy in the 75, and only beginning to understand. I couldn't even speak the language, because I couldn't say a sentence without breaking it. And Gary was saying, but you have no power left at the end of the line. And I says, I know, I don't know. And she said, well, it doesn't make any sense. And so we had to sort of develop or take it apart and put it back together and say, well, what he means is for the power to be at the end of the line, which is what Singh is about. I mean, his life is at the end of his lines, and we couldn't do it. Mick understood it, and he helped us. So after that summer season, it did okay, and we were beginning. We were so in love with Singh that we went back to it in 77, and every 2 years for the next. So when I came to do the Singh in 2006, I was ready. I mean, I knew the plays, and to be able to get into his head by playing five of lead parts in six of his plays was extraordinary. I mean, you just go into that zone, and you come out the other end. And I mean, the company she put together for that was amazing.
And the Well of the Saints is such a magnificent play.
Isn't it fantastic?
But and Riders to the Sea.
Riders to the Sea and Tinker's Wedding, the two one acts, and then Playboy, of course. And
Deirdre.
Yeah.
Will you read a little for us from Riders to the Sea?
I will. I'm going to read this. I've put a few of the speeches together. It's not very long, but just to give you an idea, if you like, of what it's about. I always thought that this was from start to finish, this play is a lament. It's a woman whose one son left, and she's on tenterhooks, in my opinion, all of her life, waiting for the sea to take the last son. And she's in a I think he has written her in such a state of grief all through the play. But anyway, I'll read this. It's not very long, but you'll get an idea. Bartley will be lost now. And let you call in Eamon and make me a good coffin out of the white boards, for I won't live long after him. I've had a husband and a husband's father and six sons in this house. Six fine men, though it was a hard birth I had with every one of them, and they come into the world. And some of them were found and some of them were not found. But they're gone now, the lot of them. There was Stephen and Sean, were lost in the great wind and found after in the Bay of Gregory of the Golden Mouth, and carried up the two of them on the one plank and in by that door. There was Seamus and his father and his own father again, were lost in a dark night, and not a stick or sign were seen of them when the sun went up. There was Patch after, was drowned out of a curragh that turned over. I was sitting here with Bartley and he a baby, lying on my two knees, and I seen two women and three women and four women coming in, and they crossing themselves and not saying a word. I looked out then, and there were men coming after them, and they holding a thing in the half of a red sail and water dripping out of it. It was a dry day, Nora, and leaving a track to the door. They're all gone now, and there isn't anything more the sea can do to me. I'll have no call now to be up crying and praying when the wind breaks from the south, and you can hear the surf is in the east and the surf is in the west, making a great stir with the two noises, and they hitting one off the other. I'll have no call now to be going down and getting holy water in the dark nights after sowing. And I won't care what way the sea is when the other women will be keening. Give me the holy water, Nora. There's a small sup still left in the dresser. Michael has a clean burial in the far north by the grace of God. Bartley will have a fine coffin out of the white boards and a deep grave, surely. What more can we want than that? No man at all can be living forever. And we must be satisfied.
Marie Mullen reading from Sing's Rise to the Sea. That last line always gets me. We must be satisfied. Marie, what are your memories of Siobhan McKenna? I remember seeing you both in that extraordinary production of Tom Murphy's magnificent play, Ballygan Gyra. And I suppose Siobhan seemed to be one of these rare spirits who seemed almost to embody the art of theatre.
Oh, she was extraordinary. I mean, she was so loved in Galway. I mean, everybody stopped her in the street when she came down and said, oh, welcome back. And she'd tell them what she was doing and all that. But she was, heads would turn every time she walked into the room. She just had this amazing quality. And so generous. Mary McAvoy and myself, she took us under her wing with that play and was so generous and caring and patient with us as we tried to somehow be worthy of her presence in one way. I mean, we adored her. We adored her. And in this day and age, it's very hard to say things like that about another human being, but it was genuine love and genuine adoration. But she was extraordinary, and what she did with Ballygan Gyra will remain forever imprinted in my mind. I mean, she embodied the whole, this woman who couldn't finish a story. I mean, she took the audience with her. I remember she used to say, if she didn't like somebody who was sitting in the front row of Druid, she'd say, because she had to eat this, and she was her head was supposed to be, she was supposed to be gone in the head. She says, oh, I'll just take a sup of my soup and I'll spit at him. And she used to do, she'd be doing, she, She used to send these bits.
The actor's revenge.
But, you know, I mean, in that way, she was fantastic. A sense of humour, but an amazing logical mind. Her father was a mathematician here in this very university. He taught mathematics, I think, didn't he, Patrick? And she had the same logic about the way she approached the work. And Gary and Tom would come in and say, Siobhan, we think it's a bit too wordy there. And she would get very annoyed or very suspicious if they suggested cutting anything. So they thought they might cut this. And she says, but if you cut that, it doesn't add up at the lines 10 pages before. So it all had to add up for her, and she wouldn't allow it if it didn't, you know.
She saw the big picture.
She really did. And she was extraordinary. I mean, she was the most extraordinary actress I think we ever had in our whole lives. I mean, she was so amazing. Really.
I suppose that idea of an actor who has this mathematical mind and this really strong sense of logic illustrates something of the complexity of the art of acting. Because sometimes it seems that so many almost indefinable things come together to make for great acting, and it can be maths, it can be a steely will, a particular way of looking at things. I mean, there's so much that can go into that.
There is. I think, I mean, on the floor with Gary and myself, and you know, it's always if the scene isn't working, it's about the writer initially. I mean, I'm going to say that again and again today. If you're lucky enough to have good writing, you're halfway there as an actor. But even with the good writing, sometimes a scene won't work, and then you have to look to the director or the actor or the particular way it's set up. So it's you're always excavating, it's really hard. I think it's really hard because you won't come across with honesty if you don't know what you're doing. And you have to know, and even, you know, when you do sort of, if you're on the path to knowing where you're doing, it looks really easy. Acting looks really easy. It looks like, it's the most natural thing in the world to you. But it's actually not. It's, and if you don't put the work in, you don't get the returns. And it's difficult, but there is an awful lot of logic and tying up involved with the scripts.
I think you'd say that an actor has to be strong, that actors have to be very, very strong people. There isn't really much room for the perceived fragility at times.
There really isn't. And people have an idea that actors are, you know, frail and airy-fairy people. I think they're the most realistic, most logical people I've ever met in my whole life. And also they're very thick-skinned because, you know, nobody ever sets out to be bad, and we all go through the process, and sometimes things don't suit us and we're not good in them. And even on the first night, we know that this is not what we should be doing. You know, we make bad choices sometimes. Sometimes we make good ones, or sometimes we make the best of a bad lot, but we're always striving to be better. And it's very hard, you know, when you get criticised in a bad way, you know.
Michael Frayn's line that I quoted earlier about, you know, actors like writers must bring their own living selves to the enterprise of theatre. Would you concur with that? That you must bring almost everything you know, everything you've lived, everything you've experienced, all the pain and hurt and joy and wonder? And
I think you do, because I think when you have a response to a script, it's a response that you have out of your life, you know. I mean, and the emotions that a script will awaken in you are emotions that you've already felt in similar situations in your life. And I think it's about inhabiting a person, but also staying true to yourself and your own personality. And that's, I think, an awful lot of people's personalities are in acting. You know, I mean, look at Bette Davis in that sister's movie.
Whatever Happened to Baby Jane?
Extraordinary, but there was so much of her in it too. That big lumping way she went around the place, you know, and the red lipstick and the extremities. You know, I mean, she understood about being extreme, you know. And I mean, you have to bring different qualities of yourself to various things.
I presume you can't really be afraid either. You have to be able to just jump in there
you
and
can't,
let go.
You can't. You have to let go and you have to perform. But it's also, it's great to have somebody who supports you, like somebody like Gary Hines, who's all for the work and will support you in every way, especially if you're travelling down a road that you're not quite sure of, or that maybe is not, is too far or something. As long as you give it all you can and...
And know that you can be pulled
back.
Yeah. How do you get, and I suppose this is something a lot of people probably ask you and a lot of people wonder about in relation to acting, is how do you keep a role fresh? You know, we'll say Beauty Queen, where when you were performing on Broadway, I think were you doing eight performances a week?
Eight performances a week.
Like, how
a year.
Did you go out and make that somehow fresh for the new audience every time?
I have no idea. It was a nightmare. I mean, they talk about, you know, the show must go on. I said, if I have to do this once more, I'll kill somebody.
Yeah,
if I have to kill Anna Manahan once more, I'll really kill her. But I think what happens is you never get complacent, because you get frightened and you say, you know, I can phone this in. You might say that once, and then you're in front of an audience and you have to stay true. This is a piece written by Martin McDonagh. You have no right to phone it in. It's not your job. So I think what really helped me was the audience, knowing that this was their first time ever hearing this. And they would keep me fresh, because this word that's coming out of my mind is the first time you're ever hearing this. So I must make it land. And I must make sure that you're there with me in the story, because if you're not there, then you're never going to be there when I get to that part. You know. So you're constantly adding up with your audience. And you can feel if they're with you or you've lost them, and say, oh, you have to get them back. So it's a constant journey that's happening in the moment. It's not something that happened last week, you know.
John McGarren's play, The Power of Darkness, which you played in the Abbey Theatre, and I saw it. And despite the critical reaction at the time, I suppose that play is still considered by some people to be something of a masterpiece of theatre. And we'll hear an extract from that play in a while. You're a big admirer, though, I think, of McGarren's writing.
Yeah. I mean, he's just... It's just the way he lived his life as well as the way he wrote. I mean, he loved walking through his lanes in Leitrim, and his writing captures country people, I think.
I suppose, again, like the best actors, he was never afraid.
He was never afraid to do
what he wanted to do.
And he's a bit like Tom Murphy. He's not afraid to show us as we are. I mean, Tom's bravery about the Irish. I mean, we can be bad and we can be great, but we can be horrible, but we can be wonderful, all in the one person. And he doesn't patronise us. He doesn't talk down to us. He gives us beautiful things to hold on to, and he makes us look at our dark side. And I mean, that's the reality of it. Everybody knows about that.
And there was great darkness in McGarren's play.
It was so dark. That play we did in the Abbey, it was such a dark place to go. But the reviewers didn't like it, but the audience made it. The audience came and supported us and clapped us, and an awful lot of them left messages, waited for us after, said, please don't pay any attention to the newspapers, because this play is wonderful and it needs to be seen. And I will never forget that reaction at the time, because it was the truth. And I've seen the same with Murphy. Irish audiences will come, and if you tell them the truth, they will stay.
We'll talk about Tom Murphy and his work in a while, but before that, you recorded in an RTE radio drama production, you recorded McGarren's Power of Darkness. Let's hear an extract from that.
Poor Peter, it's plain to the world, is on his last legs. You're a young woman, the best part of your life still ahead of you. What's happening is only healthy. And wouldn't I be a strange sort of mother to stand in her son's light?
I don't care about anything as long as he doesn't have to leave.
Then you don't have to worry your head, love. That's just the raving of yon old Amazon of mine. Once an idea gets set in his head, nothing short of a crowbar is fit to dislodge it.
Who started it all then?
Well, our lad is sort of harmless like his father, and he's good looking. The women seem to go for him like bees to the honey. Before he came here, he was working in town as one of the week on, week off fellas. He used to go into the American bar. There was this girl working in the bar they were said to have got out of some orphanage run by the nuns. You know the sort.
Was that Rosie?
Rosie. Whether anything happened or not, I wouldn't know. But anyhow, that old Amadon of mine got wind of something about the town. It wouldn't surprise me if it was all put around by herself. They all know how gullible my old boy is.
She can't be let get away with it.
Well, anyhow, my old boy got all in a tether. He must marry the girl. He'll have to do right before God. I tried to get him to see there might be more than one side to the story, but you might as well be trying to humour a jackass. Well, if the front door doesn't open, always try the back door, because you have no use going against the men once they get an idea. You have to pretend to see it their way. Well, I said, if that's the way it is, he'll have to marry her. But first, we'll have to try to find out his side of the business. So, love, here we are.
What if he still orders Paul to marry her? Paul is still sort of in awe of his father, a fear to go against him in anything.
Order, is it? Why, the man wouldn't know how to order his breakfast. Baby only brought him here to get him turning in circles. There'll be no marrying. You can take it from me. Baby knows which side of her bread is buttered.
Marie Mullen there in John McGarren's Power of Darkness. Marie, Tom Murphy and his work. Tom came into Druid at a particular time in the 80s, writer in association, and together you made these amazing productions. And I'll never forget then later you coming through that door on the Abbey stage in The Last Days of a Reluctant Tyrant and the power of that entrance, that opening speech and that role. Tom, and you talked about it already, also incredibly supportive of actors and really understands the art of acting and of writing for the actor.
He made us grow up. When he came to be a writer in the association, I think what year it was, maybe 84, 85, we had achieved some things as a company, and the core company were very strong, Gary at the helm. But when Tom came, he made us attach our maturity to what we were doing. And he also gave us time. Like for Baile Gongora, well, that was later, Gary did not come into the room for a week. Tom was there with the three actors, and there was no such thing as a stupid question. Anything we wanted under the sun, he told us why he wrote it and how he wrote it. He was really a great help, another dimension to acting altogether. And for Conversations on a Homecoming, it was originally a play called The White House, and he shortened it. It was a two-act, he shortened it to a one-act, and it was just extraordinary watching us all mature and become grown up with those words that we had to. Well, we had to, because we had to be mature to deal with that script. You know?
And again, the sense of music and musicality in Tom's work is so powerful and so precise. Does music carry you at all as an actor, or is it all really down to the words, to the script, or is there ever a sense of music that pulls you or carries you?
Well, I hear the music, and if I can hear the music in a script, I'm thrilled. Like sometimes I don't, but with Tom, it's like a symphony every time. But well, music is important to me. But I find I go through phases of liking something. Like for instance, when Sean, my husband, was doing A Whistle in the Dark in the Abbey, he was playing Tommy Peoples all the time because there was a darkness in his fiddle playing that was. Now that has never, like, so directly happened to me when I'm doing a show, but if there's music, if some music associations with plays, like the Pachelbel, I associate with Tennessee Williams, The Glass Menagerie, because Gary picked it to be with the band. It was so perfect. And then in that 1975 production of The Loves of Cass McGuire, she used Madame George of Van Morrison's Madame George, which was doesn't sound like it would fit immediately, but it was fantastic. It was like it raised the play up to another level right from the start, you know.
It's shock of contrast, of course.
Yes, indeed.
It's so
yes.
Fantastic. The relationship between actor and audience, you know, I suppose so much must hinge on that. Almost this form of codependency, in a way.
Completely. Yes, completely. And I mean, I used to, you can sense them coming along with you. And I think it's really important. You feel secure. You feel they give you a security with your words and all that. But I remember in the Beauty Queen, they really liked my character for the first three quarters of the play. And I used to go, oh, I have to turn them on me now. because they had to. And I used to wait every night for the intake of breath when they realised they'd backed the wrong horse, you know, in the play. And I just used to hate it every night. So why can't they love me forever? But you know, that's just a child talking. I mean, you can't. You have to be. But I could feel them going. You know, there was a section in the play where Martin turns the tables and it's just, it's unbearable. It's really painful, actually, for the audience to go. And I used to hate them having to go through it. But at the same time, if they didn't go through it, I'd be worried. But it was awful that they had to sort of pull away from me. And you could feel the coldness coming in. Saying, oh, my God, the poor mother. You know, the first was the poor daughter, you know. But, I mean, that's the kind of thing that you go through every day, really. It's because it's a living thing.
Is there such a thing, as we say, as a bad audience? Do you ever have a night where you think they're not with me at all for whatever reason? You know, they're just...
Well, I don't believe it anymore. But in the early days, we used to say that Friday night audiences were always bad because the wife dragged the husband to the play and he wanted to go to the pub. And now he couldn't go to the pub till Saturday night. But I think that's all a myth, really. We used to find that they were really quiet on a Friday night. But I've had brilliant Friday nights in the theatre since, so it's just all making up. I really don't think there is a bad audience. No, I don't. I've never entertained that idea in my head now.
Individual members.
Maybe individual members, yes.
Winning the Tony Award, what was that like? I mean, it must have been great.
It was fantastic because it was so unexpected and we were in this strange country and we were lauded. We knew the play was good, but we knew we had good work. But I mean, this was extraordinary. But I believe that with theatre, there's a pulse. You know, the theatre in America at that time was looking for something and, you know, we were it. There was something new, there was something involved, there was something honest about that. And it hit somebody somewhere. The whole nation took off on it. And we were delighted with the Tonys. The night of the Tony was when Liam Neeson presented me with mine. And I mean, that was amazing, one of our own, you know. And it was just, the four of us won that night. We were just... I still can't describe it. It was like living on another planet. And the praise from home and everything. Of course, we had to continue on. Everybody went, this was the Sunday night. By Monday, everybody was gone home. We were still in the theatre trying to get a performance of this. We'd won four Tonys. And then we're saying, oh, my God, we better be worth it, you know, for the rest of the week. But that's the way it was. But it was wonderful.
Isn't that the thing, you know, with acting, you have to go on. You have to go on the next night, you know, no matter what the praise or the opposite, matter what the criticism.
Yes,
you have to go back on stage. You have to keep working, and that's again, you referenced it already, that acting is really hard work, and it's often struck me that I think people don't often or don't always realize that just how hard it is.
It is. It's very hard, and. We take it very seriously because we're preparing something for people who are going to come and look at us, and the least they deserve is the best we can do, whatever that might be. But it must be the best we can do, you know.
You mentioned, you know, being married to Sean McGinley, another very fine actor, and I'm sure I'm not alone in thinking that he's been great recently in Love Hate on
yes.
telly. And you've two daughters together, a life to get on with, every day. To live.
Yeah.
Was it ever hard, or is it ever hard, balancing the demands of theatre or acting and family life?
It is hard balancing, but I've never felt that I was deprived in any way by the girls, our two girls, and I've never felt deprived of work. In any way, I mean, if it was a thing that I couldn't do it, or Sean couldn't do it because I was working, or he couldn't do it, or I couldn't do it because he was working, and somebody had to be with the girls, I never felt in any way deprived, or I never felt I missed anything, because to get those two girls in our lives was so important to us. And it's worked out great that we've worked it so that one of us is always with them, and a lot of the time the two of us were there. They're grown up now; they're 16 and 21, so they've got opinions and lives of their own. God knows, but in the early days it was great. I mean, Sean often say, you know, I wish you could get a job so that I could stop for a while. But as it was, I got to stay home a lot because he got film work and it pays better. And it was so it meant that I could stay. But he has often said, oh, I wish you'd get something that I could stop at home and that. But we've been lucky. We've got work through the years. We've both been very lucky, you know.
Are your daughters interested in theatre at all?
They're very interested in theatre. They love the theatre. They go to the theatre, but they're not interested in the performance side of it yet. Who knows? It must have been hard growing up with two actors. And sort of, I think there comes a time when you must want to just not be part of that world for a while and see what else is in your mind. I'm sure that's fine. But they love the theatre and they get very excited about going to the theatre and they go to see everything, both of them.
Would you go to theatre on time off when you're not working, when you're away, when you have free time? Would you, by choice, go and see what's on and keep up?
I would. I love to go to London. I used to go a lot more when I was younger, go for a weekend and take in 3 or 4 shows, whatever that might be on. Just you learn so much by watching other people on stage and also just to see things. You know, we were at the Globe in London during the summer. It was extraordinary watching Shakespeare done properly, really. Having said that, I must say I was at the Abbey last night and I thoroughly and utterly enjoyed it. I thought Owen Roe was amazing
as
Lear. Yeah, and lots of the other actors worked so hard. All the others were great as well, but particularly him. And to be able to get involved in a play is just a gorgeous thing to happen.
And of course, you're back in rehearsal for the tour.
Yes.
Again, the Murphy plays that are touring in Ireland.
Yes. Yes, there's two. We're taking out two, Conversations and Whistle in the Dark. We're not taking Famine. It's just too big to move. But I'm very excited about it. We're playing all the small towns in Ireland. I love doing Irish tours. People are fantastic the way they come out. And so we're doing, you know, things like Tralee, Letterkenny, Portlaoise, Longford, Dublin once or twice, Galway, of course, and Ennis. And a few more. I can't just rightly
but
think.
But you do really enjoy touring.
I love touring Ireland. I've always, Druid's thing was URT, Unusual Rural Touring. We used to go to the back ends of places. And we always got a great reception. And people loved the fact that people could come out of their own front door and go to see a play and didn't have to get into their car and drive to Dublin. And that was a big thing in the early days of Druid, that we were providing the service for our people, that they didn't have to travel to Dublin to see a play, that they could see it in their own local hall. And I think that's the way theatre should go.
There may be young people here today or listening at home who have the sort of burn you had to go into theatre, either as an actor, or director, designer, writer, whatever. What would you say to them? I mean, is it a life you'd say go for if you really have the passion for it?
You have to go for it if you have the passion for it, but it's not easy. I mean, there's an awful lot of people out of work, but just not to let your passion die, just because talent will out, I think, always.
Marie, will you read something else for us? Oh. Again, I think from a play you did over the years.
Okay, and I'll read you a short piece from the end of Long Day's Journey into Night. It's where Mary comes into the room. She's a morphine addict. They're trying to cure her all through the play and integrate her with her family. Now, she has two sons and a husband, but she has given in to it. She goes back to her childhood, but the rest of her family are watching her and she's gone to some other planet. And there's a great sadness about it. It's just a short piece, but it'll give you an idea of Eugene O'Neill's writing. And she comes on in the middle of the night and she sits down and she goes, I had a talk with Mother Elizabeth. She's so sweet and good. A saint on earth. I love her dearly. It may be sinful of me, but I love her better than my own mother. Because she always understands, even before you say a word. Her kind blue eyes look right into your heart. You can't keep any secrets from her. You couldn't deceive her, even if you were mean enough to want to. All the same, I don't think she was so understanding this time. I told her I wanted to be a nun. I explained how sure I was of my vocation, that I had prayed to the Blessed Virgin to make me sure and to find me worthy. I told Mother I had had a true vision when I prayed in the shrine of Our Lady of Lourdes on the little island in the lake. I said I knew, as surely as I knew I was kneeling there, that the Blessed Virgin had smiled and blessed me with her consent. But Mother Elizabeth told me I must be more sure than that. Even that I must prove it wasn't simply my imagination. She said, if I was so sure, then I wouldn't mind putting myself to the test by going home after I graduated and living as other girls lived, going out to parties and dances and enjoying myself. And then if, after a year or two, I still felt sure, I could come back to see her and we would talk over it again. I never dreamed Holy Mother would give me such advice. I was really shocked. I said, of course I would do anything she suggested, but I knew it was simply a waste of time. After I left her, I felt all mixed up, so I went to the shrine and prayed to the Blessed Virgin and found peace again, because I knew she heard my prayer and would always love me and see no harm ever came to me so long as I never lost my faith in her. That was in the winter of senior year. Then in the spring, something happened to me. Yes, I remember. I fell in love with James Tyrone and was so happy for a time. Thank you.
From Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey tonight, Marie Mullen. We have time for some questions, if any of you have a question for Marie or comment or anything you'd like to say.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
I was wondering, is there any play or playwright's work that you haven't done that you would still love to do?
There is. There's, like, I think there's, what I feel is there's still a lot of Irish stuff that I haven't done. I mean, I'd love to do Baile Con Gora someday. But I can't at the moment because Siobhan's rhythms are all in my head and they were so perfect. But I'd love to do it someday, and I'd love to do some more John B. Keane because I think he's great. Martin McDonagh, if he ever wrote another play, yes, please. Brian Friel has wonderful plays that we, Druid, have never really done. But I don't know. I'm not sure. Sometimes I forget how old I am. So I keep thinking of characters in not translations. What's the name with all the girls? Dancing at Lunasa. I keep thinking I'd love to play the teacher, but of course I'm far too old now. So I have to keep reminding myself that there's not a lot of things left, really. Well, maybe there is. Older ladies.
Hi. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about your experience as an actress, as a woman, and just like parts that you've played that you think are really, you know, good, powerful women, and also, you know, if you think that there are more women now in plays or if you still think it's a very male-dominated thing, the theatre.
Well, you know, when I started in Druid, I never once felt like I was, you know, a woman. I mean, I am a woman, but I never felt it was always the boys and ourselves. We were always the same, and the theatre is a bit like that. It equals everything out, but I've never felt. I suppose there is a lack of good parts for women in the theatre canon. I suppose there is. You know, when I think about it, I've often talked to Gary about it, but I've never dwelt on it much because. If you want to find a good part, there's plenty of stuff out there. There's also brilliant writers who haven't been translated. I would like to see a lot more women writing for the theatre. That would be fantastic. Like Marina Carr is fantastic and all that. But I just love to see people with a need to say, I want to put women at the centre of plays. Just go and find the stories and write for the theatre. But one of the most amazing parts I ever played was the Widow Quinn in Sing's, and she's really feisty and strong and everything. In fact, I loved the fact that Sing wrote her as a foil for Peggy, and he fell in love with her so much that he wrote her into the play too much, and he had to go and take her out again. So I was, for ages, I was going around trying to find where's all the bits he took out and put them back in again.
Marie, do you ever, just wonder, it strikes me, do you ever regret maybe not leaving Ireland and you know, and having a go at America, for instance? You know, winning the Tony, for example. You know, obviously, you know, you can and could do it there.
I don't regret it, and you know, people like us. I mean, I'm 59 now. We never retire. It might, you know, you keep thinking, well, maybe next year I'll do something in America. You know, it's always about that. It's not about that's all over. I did a season with the RSC, which I really enjoyed, working with British actors who have a different way of thinking altogether. It was good for me to do that. And I did some restoration comedy with them, and that was good to move out of that. And I'd love to do more Shakespeare, but in an Irish context. I think we have an awful lot to give as Irish people, and the way we think about things, I think it'd be brilliant to do more. So there's all that, but I do really want to do it at home. But, you know, if Robert Redford wants me, offers me loads of money, heck, I'll go. You can all come with me.
There we leave it. Thanks to Mary McPartland, Kate Howard and all in Arts and Action here at NUI Galway, and to all at the Bank of Ireland Theatre here on campus. Sarah Binchy produced the programme for Arts Tonight. Jimmy Breslin and Seamus and Martha run sound. Thanks to Marie Mullen, to you, our audience. From all of us in Galway, goodbye.